Good evening. So I entered the hall this evening, just now, out of breath, rapid heartbeat, hands shaking. Because what you're going to get this evening is hot off the press. I mean, seconds. And then, of course, when I was, you know, finally coming over here, I went to the printer to get a paper, and it wasn't there. And I had turned my computer off. So it's always kind and compassionate when we're aware of these heightened states of energy to really bring our awareness to them and to settle down, even to speak to our heart and still it. So I feel resourced now. And I'm happy to be here this evening with you all. So we've just passed through the heart of the retreat. And our tendency is to turn our sights towards what is to come. The invitation really is to stay right where you are. Be in this present moment. It's so tempting to start looking to, you know, what's going to come next and leaning into it. Don't let your practice get away from you. Stay right where you are. You know, it's in moments and times like this, like we're coming on the downhill side. We've gone into the heart. Now we're coming on the downhill side. And this is when the practice really shows up. Our commitment to the practice really shows up. When we stay present in the midst of that pull to lean into the future. So stay with it. Keep going. You know, it's not called the heart of the retreat for nothing. You know, right in the heart of the retreat is really when we begin to crack open. Our hearts begin to crack open. Sometimes beforehand, but usually when we get right into that, and I don't care how long the retreat is. If it's a month long, it won't start happening until 2 weeks in. Yeah. So, you know, it takes a few days to settle in, to get rested, to find our rhythm and our pace, to lay down all the extraneous baggage that we came here with. And now we are feeling the heart. I think we are. It's cracking open. So I want to remind you to remember that regardless of how unguarded or unprotected it may feel to experience this kind of openness, it's an act of aliveness, an act of self-love, an affirmation to our capacity to feel, and an opportunity to learn or remember that feelings, like thoughts, come and go, that no feeling lasts forever, and that our willingness to feel something, anything, journeys us to a deeper, more profound understanding of ourselves. That by cracking open, we are letting light into places that we have banished from memory and forgotten where we've nestled them into the fertile darkness. The darkness is always fertile. But even in that nestling in, they never go away. They become like seeds without love. They continue to fortify and grow in that darkness. And they can grow into grotesque forms that become unrecognizable as parts of us. But they are parts of us. And they've been neglected. And when we become aware of the deformities that we have grown in that fertile darkness, it's not uncommon for us to grieve for the rich intensity of life that we've denied ourselves. So during these past 6 days, we've encouraged ourselves to come to this space, to be together with each other. We've opened our hearts to ourselves and by association to each other, since we're just kind of rubbing up against each other in the space without voice. I believe that we have experienced during this retreat how the power of presence in gathering together and merging our individual and unique expressions of community care creates a potent medicine for personal growth and collective healing. Jack Kornfield says, by our willingness to mourn, we slowly acknowledge, integrate, and accept the truth of our losses. And by our willingness to heal together as a community in this sacred space, we acknowledge the magnified power of our combined presence to engender the medicine to heal 1,000 generations from our presence in this moment. As we allow the heart to crack open, we begin to touch into the well of grief that lives with all of us. Whether it has been banished to the recesses of memory, or whether it sits front and center in the theater of our mind-heart, it's a constant companion that stays with us for the course of our lives, this grief. I want to share a few stanzas from David White's poem, Coleman's Bed. Be taught now among the trees and rocks how the discarded is woven into shelter. Learn the way things hidden and unspoken slowly proclaim their voice in the world. Find that inward symmetry to all outward appearances. Apprentice yourself to yourself. Begin to welcome back all you sent away. Be a new annunciation. Make yourself a door through which to be hospitable even to the stranger in you. Many times, grief is a stranger that we'd rather turn away at the door. There's a book that I really love, and I bring it to every retreat that I go on. It's a book by Frances Welder called The Wild Edge of Sorrow. And in that book, he talks about 5 gates of grief. The first gate, which is obvious, but something that a lot of times we don't want to acknowledge as we live life, you know? Sometimes we, like, think we and other people are going to live forever. The first gate is that everything that we love, everything that we love, we will lose. Grief is not solely tied to death, though. It's not solely tied to the death of someone or the loss of a life. But it is characterized by loss. And yet inherent at the root of all losses is the impermanence of change. Any change that arises in our lives is accompanied by losing something. The presence of loss is the presence of transformation. That kind of slips away from us. We're busy, caught up in the sorrow and the pain, not turning towards the transformation that's happening. Loss positions us at the cusp of the unknown. It's a death that can be frightening and foreboding. The loss itself is a death. And as I mentioned early on in the retreat, we have learned to become frightened and frozen when it is not possible to see what is unknown and to understand that what is unknown is teeming with possibility. And that we have the capacity to turn our inclination of the mind towards the possibility of beauty. And yet so much we incline towards the possibility of disaster in the darkness. The grief of some losses seem like our own life is ending. However, what is happening is that we are transforming in a way that is moving us closer to the depth of our being. If we cannot embrace our grief, we undertake a journey that is many times postponed in the midst of the comfort of the familiar. You know, the comfort of the familiar is not all, it's not all cracked up to what we think. You know, it can be numbing and it can be deadening just to, you know, not push against the edges of what's familiar to us. It is our habits of attachment to our identities around what is no longer a part of our lives that generates the grief of transformation. The habits of attachment to our identities. When loved ones and circumstances change, so do the identities that we have created and taken on. Those are losses, losing those identities. But in some ways, they can be freedoms. Circumstances like the end of marriage or relationship, the loss of a parent or a beloved friend. It's also painful to witness changes in physical or mental capacities in ourselves and in those we love and care about. These two are all identity-changing circumstances that accompany a shift in the roles that we have become used to. Change and impermanence. Grief can accompany fear when there is a loss of safety and we witness the daily dangers of leaving our homes and gathering in public places, something so prevalent right now. When routines change in our work life, when there is a loss of mobility when aging and sickness, when these things change the very fabric of our lives. You know, we can even have deep grief when we've lost some precious item that we have possessed or we feel that we have possessed. It can cause tremendous suffering. These things spring up as a heartache. And also when dreams we have held close to our longing evaporate and are gone. When whatever identity that was wrapped up in that specific relationship departs, we experience a grief, a loss. When we listen closely, grief can bring us into an investigation of our identities. And show us insights into the impermanence and the emptiness. I bet if you just sat for a moment and thought about the many identities that you have had in your life that have come and gone. Come and gone. I was once an infant. And then I was an adolescent. And then I was a mother. And even though I still have children, I've shifted from being a mother to be a grandmother and then a great-grandmother. But I still have my children. But how do I call them my children? Do I still call them my kids? They're so grown. They have their own families and they have their own children and their own grandchildren. I was once a student. And so many other things. Another gate of grief is the grief of the places within us that have not known love. So this is a grief of something that we may have never had. Not something that we had and we lost. This can manifest as a sense of not belonging and not having a place to turn, to return to, not knowing where to go to receive the gift of wholehearted welcome and love that is truly our birthright. This can be a wicked grief. This lack of sense of belonging. Too often within our community, within this community, and within so many marginalized communities, we are exiled into barren places, devoid of love. It's a deep grief to have no place of refuge. But this speaks and points us to towards the importance of cultivating Kalyanamitta, which is the Pali word for spiritual friends. We can take agency to create our places of refuge. We can create a refuge for our heart and for the hearts of those others who are walking the path. I mean, here we are in the center right now, and I'm not sure of all of the people who contributed to creating the center, but it was somebody's idea to create a space where spiritual friends can come together and cultivate those friendships. Isolation in loneliness and in practice can be deadening. But we don't have to have that. We have agency. Reach out with all your might towards others who are walking the spiritual path to cultivate ethics in life and behavior. This is where we find our refuge. This is where we find our place of belonging. When we are engaged in waking up together, the spaces of belonging can be created as our refuge. Remember, we not only take refuge in the Buddha and the Dhamma, you take refuge in the Sangha. You take refuge in the Sangha. And Thich Nhat Hanh once said that the Sangha will become the next Buddha. And even the Buddha, you know, of course, these are all translations, so who really knows what the Buddha said, but... translations 500 years later, but it is said that the Buddha insisted to his cousin and attendant, Ananda, that the Sangha is the whole of the Dhamma. The whole of the Dhamma. So we come to hear the teachings, and we come to, you know, honor the potential of becoming a Buddha, because we know that there was a Buddha, which means an enlightened one. But we behoove ourselves to really create Sangha, lasting Kalyanamitta, spiritual friendships. So never forget this. This is something we should hold dear in our hearts. The third gate of grief is the tremendous sorrows of the world. Sorrows that can seem so completely overwhelming. This huge sorrow can, like, knock us to our knees with not only grief for the circumstance, but grief for our inability to disrupt such monumental sadness. This is a wicked grief. We are truly on the cusp of extinction. So many animals and beings are daily leaving the planet. It's a wicked grief. This is the type of grief that is so colossal that it can easily create numbness in the heart. So easily. It's a grief that we must titrate, that we must turn to in intervals, lest we become swallowed in its hugeness. And yet we cannot completely turn away from it. We can't turn away from it. We're doing some incredible work just by cultivating our ethics and placing that in the world. Let us not forget that. And as we awaken and we cultivate loving kindness and compassion, it compels us to be active in the world. It's not enough for us to just wake up and then look around and it's a mess. But for that sorrow for the circumstances of the world, we must titrate. We can't go full-fledged into it. And we must continue to cultivate beautiful qualities in our life. So here is where we call upon the medicine of loving kindness and compassion. Here's where we must look to all that's beautiful. Those qualities that exist right alongside these tremendous sorrows in the world. And also here's where we turn to our spiritual family for refuge and solace. The Sangha is at the center of our well-being. Waking up together and cultivating ethics in our lives together. You know, when we open to grief, we open to one of the greatest teachers life has to offer. That's a big statement. Because grief is something that we want to turn our face away from. We don't want to feel it. We don't want to feel sorrow. We don't want to feel the pain for the world. We don't want to feel the sorrow of not having love where we should have had it, of not having a place of belonging. However, it brings us to a place of internal change. It beckons us to cultivate a mind of discernment, a heart of equanimity. It forces us into equanimity because we can't hold that. We have to balance it. It's one of the biggest teachers that we have been taught to push away. When faced, it increases our capacity to balance the pain of our loss with the gifts that arise from that pain. Now, I know that I'm probably telling you some things that you're like, you know, that's the, I don't want to do that. I know it. Our conditioning is so upside down. It's so upside down, and we're embedded in it. So these are things to ponder for your reflection. You know, don't take my word for it. You know, like the Buddha said, try it for yourself. And see if there's an opening there. Miraculously, Grief takes us on a journey to find our true self, deconstructed without embellishment, same as loving kindness metta practice, same as compassion. It takes us on a journey to find our full wholeness, offering us the capacity to let everything in. It breaks the illusion that part of our wholeness has been tied up in our identification with what is no longer there. You know, the loss of identity is a hard pill to swallow. You know, because it the illusion of it makes us feel that that's who we are, that we are something or somebody. When we can fully turn our heart, our awareness towards loss without the fear that accompanies the unfamiliar, we are then able to see the many facets of its gifts. But again, if we don't look at it, we won't see it. We'll just remain in fear. We'll remain in aversion. You know what aversion is. It's the other side of clinging and craving, and that is suffering. It's a choice. So moving on to the fourth gate of grief, which is that which we expected and didn't acquire. And that's an interesting one. You know, it's got two sides to that. This type of grief, it can show up in two different ways. Maybe more, but I only figured out two of them. That which we expected but didn't acquire. I always go back to dreams. You know, it's our dreams that give us hope in the world. A dream of a better world. They chip away at despair. They can even keep despair at bay. But the loss of dreams can really slam us down. I'm just kind of remembering a poem by Langston Hughes, but I can't quite remember the words to it. But the name of the poem is What Happens to a Dream Deferred. When we lose or abandon our dreams, we just are not the same. Many times our dreams are tied up in the lives of others. And when they leave or die or disappear or simply disengage, we can quite naturally enter into a state of grief while we're trying to re-identify our location, our position, our stance. The loss of dreams can be very sorrowful. A lot of times we have dreams and, you know, they may not readily come, but we hold on to them, and we hold on to them, we hold on to them, and then there comes that time where we just let it go. It's like it's not coming. And that is a very sorrowful time. But this gate of not acquiring what you have wanted, it can also be tied to privilege and greed. When we want something that we did not have, we know what that is. That's grasping. And the privilege part is that when we expect that it is our right to have it, and we're up against that every day. So much privilege. So much taking. Taking that has not been offered freely because of a right, a perceived right to have it. The fifth gate of grief is ancestral grief. This can be unidentifiable. You know, it can be a grief that we tend to not be able to make sense of. It leaves us wondering if there could possibly be something wrong with us. You know, our lives did not just spring up from nowhere. We are at this point because there is a long trajectory of history and legacy that brought us to this place where we are. And we have brought that with us. It's in our DNA. It's in the cellular structure of our body. It's in our bones. And ancestral grief is cumulative. And so much it goes unrecognized because we've lost our rituals. We've lost our ways to connect with that within us. You know, the grief of our pain may present itself as an indictment of this moment. What we went through today, what happened in the news yesterday, what, you know, some infraction that happened to us, that happens, you know, the 50,000 paper cuts that turn into a horrible scar, a wound. And sometimes it goes unnoticed that those daily pains of our personal experience are actually layered on top of our ancestral grief that we're holding in our bodies. Let it not go unnoticed that we carry the scars of generations of sorrow. And each loss can tap into the depth of that pain. It can flood us. And it can sometimes feel like an endless tunnel from which we'll have no return. And this is probably part of the reason why I know for myself that I pushed pain away, because I felt like I would drop down into a hole that I could never come out of. And I have to remember that no feeling lasts forever. Dr. Larry Ward, Zen teacher and author of a book entitled America's Racial Karma, affirms that While my grief is a personal experience, it's also collective and intergenerational in terms of history and epigenetics. It's an ocean of grief that requires spiritual practice and ritual. Otherwise, we drown in it. There's an artist in Oakland, artist and teacher, Angela Hennessy. And she writes, "In this moment, death is all around us. Yet many of us have inherited a death-phobic orientation to life that undermines our ability to be present with mortality." Mortality? We can't be present with mortality. You know, the truth is that we're all going to die. It's another thing to get familiar with their practices within our Buddhist practice, that really settles the awareness into death and decay and what happens to the body. And even though in our culture it seems like it's a morbidity, it actually gives us an appreciation for the life that we have. It actually shows us how empty we are, that we are not these, we're not all of this. She goes on to say that each death is an opportunity to review our personal and cultural narratives of loss that inform how we show up for life and work and love. In our contemporary world that works so hard to maintain our attachment to distraction, I mean, all of the studies are geared towards keeping us distracted. That's why it's so hard to get off of our phones and off of our computers. It is scientifically designed. Also, the sensational narratives that keep us in a heightened, you know, emotional state, you know. We have come to abandon the cultural rituals for grieving loss that were practiced by our ancestors. Those rituals were created for our well-being, so that we can be completely whole, leaving nothing out. As we all journey through the grief and loss in our lives, let us remember again that no feeling lasts forever, and that our capacity to grieve deeply indicates the level of our engagement with life. Our capacity to grieve deeply indicates the level of our engagement with life. Our conditioning denies us that. Anytime we separate out any feeling that we have, we've killed a little part of us that we need to recover. May we all remember to keep our hearts open to each moment in order to receive the medicine that grief can bring. May we learn to build communities that we can openly grieve in together without shame, without judgment, May we all embrace grief as an apprenticeship to a richer, fuller life. And I'm going to end this part in the words of a good friend of mine, Erklin Manuel, who is a Zen teacher and writer, who says, to be alive is to be full of feeling. Full of feeling. So this is the paper I had to, like, I was angsting about getting to. It's like, oh no, it didn't print, and it's time to be in the hall. This is a poem by Rainey Marie Wilka. And I'm going to change the first word in the poem so that it may land softly. You know, the first word is God, but we all have different concepts of God, and some of us ain't thinking about that anyway, so so I'm not going to bring that into the room, but I'll change it to: the unborn heart speaks to each of us as we are made, then walks with us silently out of the night. These are the words, the numinous words we hear before we begin. The title of this poem is Before the Beginning. You called forth by your longing, reach to the edge of your senses, become my body. Grow like a fire behind things, so their shadows spread and cover me completely. Let everything into you, beauty and terror. Keep going. Remember, no feeling lasts forever. Don't lose touch with me. Nearby is the land they call life. You will know it by its intensity. Give me your hand. Now, to free ourselves of all this entanglement that is ours and yet does not belong to us, that like water in an old well reflects us trembling, distorts who we are, that hooks us again and again like thorns to free ourselves from this and that we long ago stopped seeing. So familiar were they, so commonplace, and then to look back once, tender, forgiving, as if for the first time, so fresh. To realize at last how impersonal is the suffering that comes to each of us, that fills childhood to the brim, and then to free ourselves, rending hand from hand, as if to reopen a world and walk away. Where? Into the unknown. Into a warm and unfamiliar place that whatever happens remains indifferent, like a backdrop or a garden wall. And free ourselves to let go all this, to let fall all hope, to release whatever we may still be holding on to. Perhaps to die alone, not knowing why? Is this the opening to a new life? Is this the opening to a new life? The invitation now is to simply let all the words fall away. So many words. Just let them fall and settle into what is there in the body in this present moment. Notice what's present with you right now. What can you let go of? And what can you open to? Thank you for your kind attention.